Hello again, everyone. I just want to talk about a topic which I have spoken about at length in the past, I'm sure, but I just want to throw a few thoughts out there in response to something I've heard from one of my people I follow and followers, and of course, no offence intended to anybody, but I just would like to talk about immigration, not general immigration, but specific cases. As many of you will know, my husband is from outside the EU. Getting someone, my husband, into the UK was not an easy job. People in this country seem to think that we open the floodgates and let all the immigrants in, and they come in and they get houses and they get benefits. Not true. Now, my husband is from outside the EU. And he came to the UK as my husband, obviously. And anyone from outside the EU, I'm not sure how the EU immigrants, or I don't think they were the migrants, I don't know how that stands at the moment, because I know that there's been attempts to change the fact that they can claim benefits and make them wait a certain amount of time for housing, etc. I can't speak about EU migration. I'm talking about outside of the UK, EU, sorry. Now, when you come to the UK, unless you're an asylum seeker, which again, I don't know a lot about, so I can't really speak about that. But I think here we're just talking general immigration. You are not entitled to benefits or a house. The only thing you can tap into is the NHS. Obviously, the UK is not so barbaric as to let somebody in here and let them die because they couldn't see a doctor here. So they are not. This is a fallacy so many people believe. They say all these Indians come over here and they get houses. No, they don't. They don't get houses and they don't get benefits. Nothing, not one scrap of benefit. Now, my husband works. He works hard. He takes low-paid jobs, and I'm not saying that no one in the UK would do them, but I do hear that a lot of UK citizens, born and bred here, sit and moan that they can't find a job, but, you know, I'm sorry, he always has managed to find one. He hasn't been out of work since being here. He's had a succession of different jobs because working in the lower-paid sector like care work and other stuff, you do get cowboy companies that mess up your payment, and you know they say they're going to pay you for a week's work, and then they only give you 2 days, and so you have to keep fighting for your money. But it's not easy to get here, and the topic of conversation was that people come here, they earn money, and they send it back to their families, and then they leave the UK. Okay, so I'm going to turn that on its head a bit. And I'm going to talk about people, members of my own family, not my immediate family. They've worked abroad, earned a lot of money, sent it back here to the UK, and then come back here to live. So it's okay it seems to me that people think that it's okay for us to go and work abroad, send money home to our families, earn a lot of money. My aunt and uncle, they're my parents' ages, my dad's twin sister, and her husband's dead now, but they worked in Mexico, they earned a lot of money. They worked in the Gulf, in the Middle East, and they earned pots of money. They worked out there for years. And what did they do? Come home and bought a huge, great house. And no one says anything about that. The immigrants, the people that you know, want to come to the UK, they don't say to the benefits office, oh, I want to come here for a better life. That's not a reason to get into the UK. I'm sorry, but it's not. If you're an asylum seeker, you might have run away from a war-torn country, or you might get here and pull a fast one and say you have, and that's for them to decide whether you're telling the truth or not. But you don't have any dealings with the benefits agencies when you're coming from outside the EU. It just doesn't happen because you're not entitled to anything. So it does annoy me a bit that people just jump on this immigration bandwagon. Yes, we have to tighten up immigration because we are only a small country. But the immigrants do bring a lot to this country. Where would we be in the NHS? Where are all the nurses? Where are all the British nurses? You know, doctors. I don't know where they've all gone, whether they just don't want to train to do such things anymore in this country. I don't know what the answer is, but the NHS is full of foreigners, and without them, I think it would fall flat, to be quite honest. And you go to a hospital and you look from the very bottom to the very top. The porters, nearly all of them are African or Asian, and then you go to the cleaners, the nurses, the doctors and the consultants, and, you know, you'll find that, I'm not saying a vast majority, but especially in the nursing sector, so many people are from overseas, and they do a really good job. And, you know, where would we be without them? I don't know. And you look at the railway industry, the underground. I don't know. I just think there's a lot of unemployment in the UK, and but I think mostly the jobs are out there if people really want them. My son, who's 17 and a half, coming up for 17 and a half, is looking for a job. And OK, he's having trouble finding one, but it's not because all the foreigners are taking them. It's because he's got no experience, or very little. He did work in a charity shop for a couple of days a week for 6 months or so. And because his school qualifications aren't great, because he didn't stay on into the sixth form, and he's under 18. A lot of jobs, you have to be 18 before they'll even consider you, even jobs working in shops. It isn't easy to get into the UK, even as someone's husband or fiancé, let alone if you just want to come here for the sake of coming here. If you come as an international student, the amount of money you need up front is absolutely astronomical. I know, because when we were applying for my husband to come here, we looked at all the criteria, not that he was going to come as a student, but just in finding what we needed to know, I just looked at all the other information as well. Someone who comes to the UK has to have a sponsor. And that sponsor, I'm not sure the rules may have changed, because they do seem to constantly change, but they need to be earning £18,600 a year, and that's not in benefits. However, if the sponsor is on DLA, which I am, then that is waived. And the onus, I suppose, is then more on the person coming to the UK to prove that they have enough money. Because as it stands, if I hadn't been on DLA, and I'm obviously not working at the moment mostly due to health issues, then I wouldn't have been able to get him in the UK, no matter how much he had. So one of the reasons I do advise people, if they are trying to get someone into UK, to obviously go to a solicitor and be prepared to pay, which we did, extortionately, for a proper immigration solicitor. I don't think any normal, in my experience has been, when I was trying to look for someone to represent my husband, and our case that you can't just go to any ordinary solicitor because they won't, some of them just won't touch immigration at all. There's so many, it's a minefield and there's so many pitfalls. So you do need to go to someone who specialises in it. The other thing, I know of several cases of people, I don't really know them, I know one personally, but I know of people, blind couples, who are trying to get a partner or a fiancé or somebody into the UK from overseas, from outside the EU. And it depends where they're coming from. I think some countries are probably easier to get in from than others. Sorry about that. I had a phone call and I've completely lost my train of thought. I was saying that anyone who comes to the UK... Oh, yeah, I was talking about... when my husband came to the UK, amidst all your application stuff, which is a lot, we had to have proof of all our conversations, printouts of phone, itemised phone calls, any cards or stuff we'd sent one another, and, you know, conversations on social media, everything you can think of. They practically wanted to know how many times, if we'd ever wiped each other's backsides, putting it politely. So we got all that, and then the solicitor writes a covering letter recommending the reasons why, or it was in my case a she, thought that my husband ought to be given a settlement visa in the UK. And one of the things that she put in his favour was that he is employable, he's got a degree, you know, he's a graduate, he's got his transferable skills, and therefore he's not, you know, not that he could be a drain on the system because he couldn't claim benefits, but he's going to do okay and get a job and be self-sufficient. One of the couples I know that they're not on audio boom, as far as I know, are trying to get into, the lady is living in the UK and her husband is coming from the States. Her partner. He's been coming back and forth to the UK for 6 or 7 years now and staying for a few months and then going back again. But he is not able to work. I don't know what his situation is. I'm sorry, here come the bin men. He's not able to work, so apparently his country will continue to pay him benefits for 2 years once he's here, but after that it's very much down to whether, I don't know whether he can claim in the UK or not, because he, you know, certainly for my husband and anyone coming out from outside the EU that I know of, you have to be here 5 years before you can claim anything. It used to be 2, but they put it up to 5. So I don't know where this person would stand, whether they would accept him into the UK if he's not really employable, because he could potentially be a drain on the system. It is very difficult. As I say, it's a minefield. And the trouble with these people is they don't take emotions into account. They just look at the bare facts. You can't try and get around them by saying, I've done all that, believe me. My husband's application was actually turned down because the solicitor that we paid so much money for told me I did not need to put proof of my DLA in the application, because the fact that she'd written that I was on DLA was enough. Of course, they had my national insurance number, and they were well able, if they had really wanted to, and they weren't clutching at straws to turn yet another person down, to have contacted the government departments here and found out that I was on DLA. But they didn't. Instead, they refused his application on the grounds that we did not include the government letter, the entitlement letter. So we actually put in for a review, which we couldn't do for 6 weeks because you have to give it time to get onto all the documentation to get onto the system. And then after 6 weeks, we put in to ask for a review. And if the review had been turned down, it would have gone to an appeal, which would have been held in the UK, and I would have had to have attended court on his behalf, which I think is a bit stupid. But I would have done it, and I think I could have probably given a good case. And my solicitor did say that there was no way, it was 100% guaranteed that if it had gone to an appeal, that I would have won, or he would have won, because it was such a stupid reason. It was basically red tape. So his application was turned down in the middle of May in 2013. And they wrote to me, the tribunal service wrote to me and said that as from the 7th of November, they would be putting wheels in motion for the appeal. And they would write to me after that date and let me know what to do. But mercifully, at the beginning of October, we received an email, or he did, just to say that could he send his passport to Sheffield, to the visa office in Sheffield. First of all, we thought it was a hoax because it was so poorly written and the English was terrible, but it wasn't. And that was that. So we also, another thing, someone who's coming from outside the EU does not have a right to a house. If they've got nowhere to live, they won't be accepted. It's as simple as that. It's black and white. There's no grey area. I'm not talking again about asylum seekers. That's different. Someone like my husband, I had to send them a copy of my tenancy agreement, a letter from my landlord saying that he had permission to live here, and a proof that I had a three-bedroom house. Although in the situation with a partner, a husband or a fiancé or whatever, a civil partner or whatever the position might be, I think that's a bit stupid because you're pretty much going to be sharing the same room. So even a one-bedroom house would have been okay. But obviously I've got I've got a non-dependent living with me. Was he still a dependent at the time? No, I don't think he was. Or he might have just been a dependent. He might have been 18, I'm not sure. And a non-dependent. So we have got a three-bedroom house and, you know, obviously they have a room each and my husband and I share a room, naturally. So that was a bit superfluous, but it's just, again, bureaucracy, and they needed to see that, and they needed the letter from my landlord saying that it was okay for him to live here, so that they knew that he was safeguarded, he had somewhere to live, because they don't want people coming here. You know, they won't have people coming here that have got nowhere to live, because they can't offer them housing, and neither should they. It's different, as I say, with asylum seekers. And I don't know how the position is with, or what the position is with regard to EU migrants. I don't know, because that seems to change from day to day. And I do feel for people who are in the position of trying to get someone to the UK permanently. It's not easy. You've got to be prepared to fight blood and guts. Believe me, we had so many knockdowns. I'm not even going to talk about it all on here because it would take too long and it's too involved. There were so many problems. So many knockbacks. And each time we had to get up and we had to dust ourselves down and say, we're never going to give up the fight. And there were times when I thought I was never going to see him again. To be honest, I did have times, very dark times, when I thought, you know, what if I remember the last time we saw each other at the airport, and I was so upset when we had to say goodbye, and I wouldn't let go of his hand until someone was taking me, and I had to let go because he was standing there, and I walked too far away, and I couldn't hold it any longer, and we were holding up the queue to get through security. And I was really upset. You know, I was crying my eyes out because I didn't know. He thought that we were going to be together within a couple of months. And I just knew My gut instinct told me it was not going to be as easy as that, and it was more than a year and a half. Which, when you look back on it, doesn't sound that much, but when you live through each day, believe me, it's... And it's not just... If you were certain that you were going to see each other again, but we weren't... Well, he was, I think, but I wasn't at all. At times, I went through some very bad times, and of course, in that intermittent period between his application and... Or between me last seeing him and him getting here, my kidney problems went downhill, so that I ended up on dialysis. We had a fire, had all that to cope with. It wasn't an easy time, and the last year wasn't easy either, even when he was here. Not because, I mean, it was easier with him being here, but with my health wasn't that great, especially at the beginning. It got a lot better towards the end of the year. So I used to think back to that day and think, maybe that was it. Maybe I'm never going to see him again. And so when he got the email saying, can you send your... That's all it said. It just said... I think it might have said that the original decision has been withdrawn. That means the entry clearance officer made the decision to refuse his application on the grounds of having no DLA letter. But when that was presented in the review, they couldn't really do anything, so they withdrew their original decision. The only problem with that is that when you get the settlement visa, it's only for a couple of years, and then, like, by January or February next year, he's got to apply to renew it. And then that'll take him up to the 5 years when he can, if he wants to, apply for a British passport. I'm not sure that he even does. I mean, obviously he wants to stay here, but I don't know if he wants to become a British citizen. I don't even think he's decided that himself. and the thing about that was that basically, pretty much 18 months between his application, no, sorry, between him applying and the overturning of the original decision was 19 months. So that's, they take the visa date back to the original application, even though for 19 months of the time he wasn't here. That's knocked off. Do you see what I mean? If you see what I mean. So they take it back, like, as if on his visa it's from the date of his original application, because they overturned that decision, even though he couldn't get entry to the UK for another year and a half and more. So that's the way it goes. I don't know why they do it like that. So this year we've got to reapply sometime this year, because it takes a few months. I hope it all goes smoothly. You don't really see any reason why it shouldn't. I mean, he's worked, he's paying tax, he's not done anything illegal. The other thing with regard to my application was that he wanted to be tested as a possible kidney donor for me, which he did do. But we did put this to the immigration as another reason why they should allow him to come here. But we were warned by the solicitor not to lay too heavily on that, rely too much on that, because if we emphasised it too much, they might think we were doing some kind of deal, like, I'll get you into the UK if you give me your kidney, which obviously wasn't the case. He was tested for it when he arrived, and we weren't really a match. It could be done. We could still do it, but with different blood groups. I can't remember now. I think I'm A and he's B. And so they're not compatible. They're not impossible, but it would mean I'd have to undergo a lot of more immunosuppressant treatment beforehand, which in itself brings up some problems. And the likelihood of rejection is greater than someone with a perfect match. So I'm still waiting to get onto the transplant list, because I think I can just get onto that now and see what happens. But at any point, we could still decide to go ahead with that. we haven't ruled it out. We just haven't made a decision either way. But the most important thing is to get onto the waiting list and then, you know, see how it goes. I've still got one more test, which I haven't heard anything about, actually, but I'll try and chase that up next week when I'm up there to see if I can get that done. And then know if I'm able to have the transplant. All the tests have been good so far. They're on your heart and stuff like that. So I don't know whether they did take that into account when they considered his application. I rather think they probably didn't that much. But I think what they did realise is that we were never going to give up because we just pestered them. But that's another thing. You've got to just pester the hell out of them. You just don't let things lie. I went to my MP and I got him involved, even though he's a stuck-up so-and-so. He's the brother of Boris Johnson. He's very stuck-up, but I can't, and I'll never vote for him in a million years. But he did help me. He did act as a kind of go-between, and I think he did speed up the review a bit. And I was thankful for that. You know, his job is as a local MP is to help his constituents, and he did help me. I will admit he did. He's more stuck up than Boris Johnson, by the way. But, you know, having said that, I don't know how much he did personally or whether it was his office, but, you know, I had ongoing correspondence with them. And, you know, they sent me letters that they'd written to the immigration people, and he did help. So that's another road we, you know, and the solicitor wasn't very keen on me doing that either. But I thought, you know what, to hell with it, you know. She was responsible, really, for it being refused because she gave me the wrong information and she never really admitted it. Well, I never really confronted her over it because she was a very temperamental woman. We almost came to blows before that. Yeah, it's not easy. It's a minefield. You've got to be prepared to be strong and to fight if you want to get someone here. And proving that it's genuine is obviously part of it, but it's not the whole of it, because, as I say, if they think at some point down the line that person might not be able to pay their way, then I think they're less likely to accept the application, you know, to grant the visa. Okay, sorry about that. Anyway, I think I've probably talked as much as I can about this subject from my own personal point of view. Obviously, you know, everyone is entitled to their opinion, and, you know, how they see things probably are different from the way I see things. Having been through it, I've probably got a slightly different perspective on the matter. And I suppose that just colours how you see things. Oh, it's raining again. Haven't we had enough rain? Really? I think it is anyway. I realise this is a very emotive subject, and, you know, I don't want to upset anyone or get anyone's backs up. And I realise that some people in this country live in areas where there's a lot of immigration and there's a lot of racial tension. I live in Orpington, which is North Kent, South East London. It's a London borough, but we've got a Kent address. And I'd say the majority of people, it's a predominantly white area. There are, you know, ethnic minorities here, and there's quite a few Eastern Europeans, Polish and the like. But just a few miles up the road in southeast London, there are a lot of immigrants, and I think that we just have to accept, and I think people in this area generally do, that we live in a multicultural society. London is multicultural, and I think it's all the better for that, in my opinion. I mean, you know, you can go to a market in, I don't know, Lewisham or somewhere like that, and you can pick up every kind of African fruit and food and vegetables under the sun. It's a very varied area to live in. You know, you don't have to go very far before you can find pretty much anything you want in the food department. And I just think it makes the UK a more interesting place to live. And let's face it, we Brits are not exactly renowned for staying at home in our own country, are we? I mean, you only don't have to go too far back in history to see that we pretty much colonised the world. So let's not forget our history, okay? Most people have fought for their independence from the UK and got it and celebrate it. But it wasn't too far back that we took over the world, pretty much. Now, that's simplifying things, I know, but... And we do have colonies of us abroad still, like Spain. You've got all the expats. They have their own schools and their own supermarkets. I know, because I've actually stayed in these places. One year we rented a villa, and it was in that part, a part where it was all, like, a lot of retired people. Actually, they were a miserable bunch of gits. We rented this villa and we had to share a swimming pool with people in the complex, because they owned their properties and we were only renting it. They were so miserable about the kids in the pool. And it was all lit up at night. It was nice, but because they didn't want us going in there at night, they turned all the lights off. They were so miserable. And from what I can see, the majority of people who come to the UK are quite happy to be here and to fit in. I know some communities don't fit in as well as others because they're quite cellular. I'm talking in particular of like some Asian communities, because they tend to keep themselves to themselves. And people say, when in Rome and all that, well, yeah, okay, but... You know, that in a way it's a good thing that I think we ought to be building bridges with these people and them with us, and not you know, having destructive comments and stuff about these people coming to our country and all that. You know, they do bring a lot to the country. Where would we be, for instance, without all the Indian restaurants? For goodness sake, it's... Well, the most popular meal in Britain now is curry, apparently. Where would we be? We wouldn't, you know, for a start, we wouldn't have that. I love curry, even though I'm a vegetarian. I really love curry. I would hate to think my life would be much duller without curry. And that's just taking a humorous look at things. But it's true. And... if people want to worship in their own temples and mosques and things, well, why shouldn't they? You know, there was a bit of trouble in not that far from here last year because some white supremacists burst into a mosque and refused to take their shoes off, which is just totally disrespectful, and demanded they take down the signs that say that women go in another entrance. Well, you know... that's not how we do things in British society, maybe. But, you know, it's someone else's religion and we need to kind of respect that. And I feel sorry for Muslims in this country at the moment, I really do, because with all the stuff going on in the world with the Islam stuff, you know, the bombings and the terrorist activity, because it's so widely publicised and because they're radicalists and it's a minority, although it doesn't feel like that because of the amount of media coverage it receives, people tend to forget that the majority of Muslims are not like these people. They're peace-loving people. They are just like everyone else, just trying to get on with their life the best they can. And unfortunately, although these things have to be publicised because A, we need to know, and B, we need to be aware because obviously we are in the West are a target. So we need to know that these things could happen here and have done. It does rather have a bad knock-on effect for those people because there's a lot of British people who are pretty ignorant and who just tar everyone with the same brush and they say, oh, yes, these people, they come over here bombing out, taking our jobs, bombing our cities and wanting to kill us all in our beds and all this stuff. And it does, I think, create tension. And I'm not saying it's all on our side either, you know, all on the British people's side. Sometimes there is animosity from these communities. I can't say that it doesn't happen because when you have racial tension, it's not always one-sided. It's not always that clear-cut, and it's not always just like white and black or white and Asian. There's often lots of different layers in between, you know, different black people. You know, obviously in Africa, there's tribes are war with one another. And even in this country, there's a bit of tension sometimes between the West Indian culture and the African culture. I mean, my ex-brother-in-law is Jamaican-born. And, you know, he'd always, as an insult, call someone an African. Oh, you African. And that's meant to be an insult, which is really stupid, because as I pointed out to him, the Caribbean were all Africans originally. That's where they came from. So look up, man. Your ancestors are African. And actually, Obi says he looks really Nigerian. So, you know, I just wish we could all be a bit more tolerant of one another. And I know I've gone way off track from the immigration topic now, but it kind of all does connect. People jump on the UKIP bandwagon, for instance, and they reckon they're not racist, but I'm sorry. I don't really buy that one. I mean, how many of their representatives have made racist comments? We have the Bongo Bongo Land. We have another one in Kent where a female UKIP MP, I think she's an MP or potential MP or member of the party anyway, didn't realise that there was a microphone, and she referred to one of their supporters who was from Thailand as a Ting Tong. She said, oh, whatever her name, I can't remember the lady's name. Oh, well, we can count on support, we can count whatever her name was. Sorry, I don't know her name. That's not what she said, that's what I'm saying. Who she's from China or wherever she's from. Oh, well, she's a Ting Tong anyway. A Ting Tong. So that was caught on microphone, and then there was Bongo Bongo Land. I mean, there's been so many different things. And unfortunately, it scares me that UKIP, they jump on this immigration bandwagon and, you know, they go out putting out this publicity and they get ignorant people who don't know any better saying, yeah, we want all these people out of our country, yeah, yeah. Let's leave Europe and then we can do what we like. Well, bring back hanging, why not? That'd be the next thing probably if they got in power. God forbid. I think at that point I might have to think about moving to a different country. Please don't ever anyone let you keep getting here. If you ask me, they're only one step away from the BNP. Anyway, I think I've said all I have to say. And I'll probably look at my list of followers later and find it's diminished by 3/4. Oh, hey ho. Such is life. Anyway, I'll speak to you all soon.